Troubles between Ireland and Britain date back to the 12th century. Since then, Irish Catholics have sought to sever all links with Britain. However, Protestants are equally keen to remain under British rule. On both sides of the divide, resistance groups were formed who used extreme violence in support of their cause. Over the years, various peace treaties have been signed, but most have failed to please both sides. And despite the efforts of men like former IRA volunteer Joe Doherty, the bad blood has continued to flow.
You knew from a very, very young age that you were a Roman Catholic, that you were a nationalist, and you were a second-class citizen. And all the main industries were all around here, but my father and uncles couldn't get jobs in them. So you always grew up with that sense of being a second-class citizen. In 1968, I was watching our small little TV, and it was Martin Luther King. I have a dream speech, and sitting back, me and my parents. At that particular time in the American Civil Rights Movement here in the 1960s, students and people from mostly from middle class and both communities formed the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Movement. And my mother was very supportive of that, so was my father. But watching the TV, you know, the civil rights marches being suppressed. The students from Queen's University have been beaten off the streets, going round to do a democratic protest at the City Hall. And as a young lad, you start sensing, well, these marches were peaceful. They were about reforms and reforming the state and giving people the right to vote, because my parents couldn't vote until they got there. And it gave a sense of hope that the civil rights movement could achieve something, and that was equality. But as history had seen, by the suppression of the civil rights movement, the Irish Republican Army come back onto the streets.
The re-emergence of the IRA increased tension between the Loyalist and Catholic communities. Loyalists began burning Catholics out of their homes, and the IRA responded in kind.
The biggest refugee evacuations in World War II happened here in the north. Over 20,000 people were burnt out of their homes, had to flee across the border, and things they got there. The British government reacted and sent the British Army in. At that particular time, we thought they were coming to save us, in the sense they were. As young squaddies coming onto the street, they sympathised with Catholics. They knew about the discrimination, they knew about the attacks on their home. But politics had taken hold, and the British Army, for some reason, had turned on our community. So I actually remember going to school, being stopped by British Army patrols 3 or 4 times before I got to school. School books were thrown onto the street, so they were very aggressive, kind of what you see in Iraq, the British Army or American forces or whatever. That kind of sense of that you were being brutalised. When you were put against the wall with your hands up against the wall, searched, you were called Irish B or whatever, things like that there. So all of a sudden, the guys who I wanted to be, because I wanted to join the British Army and supported Chelsea and I loved England football team, won the World Cup. All of a sudden, the young lad at 14, 15, I had a sense of being anti-British. And it wasn't a sense about the British people, it's what the British government was doing here. So I got involved in the rats around here, throwing stones and patra bombs, whatever. Then I joined an organisation called the Fianna Éireann, and it's an Irish Republican scout movement, but not like your normal scouts, because we were taken into small rooms like this and we were taught how to put bombs together, explosives, M1 carbines, Thompson submachine gun. When I think back, we were only 14, 15 years of age. We were children, you get the fact. But then I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to fight for Ireland. I was arrested when I was 17. I was put on an internment ship down in the docks here. Then was flew by paratroopers in January 1972 down to Long Case internment camp. And that was my first time being properly indoctrinated, because I knew what I was fighting for, but now I could have an opportunity while in prison to read in relation to history and where the field we were going with this war. You have to have an understanding of what internment was. I was taken from my home. I was taken to Girwood military barracks, tortured for 3 days, put in the back of an armoured car. I was 17 years of age and taken down and handed a bit of paper saying I was interned. I wasn't in charge of anything. I didn't have a solicitor, didn't have a judge, didn't have a prosecutor. So that kind of built up resentment when I watched the TV at night on Bloody Sunday and, you know, what the First Parishes were doing, killing people who were basically marching for civil rights and marching against people like me being in prison without charge, things like that there. So that was a kind of a, that was a watershed, because people still had a sense that we can reform the state through civil rights. Although the war was on, there's still a bit of hope the civil rights movement could move forward. Once Bloody Sunday came, that was it. I think the civil rights movement people basically principally came to the position of just folding up their banners and moving on. And that left a vacuum for hundreds of young people like me and other people to join up the IRA.
26 unarmed innocent people were shot by members of the 1st Battalion Parachute Regiment on that dreadful Sunday in 1972. The war in Ulster had truly begun.
I got out in June of 1972 and I rejoined the IRA and became involved in activities, if I could say that word, activities. Up until 1980, I was arrested. I was just not too far from here in a shootout with the SAS.
Took over the first floor of this building with an M60 and two other high caliber weapons. Basically what we're going to do, we're going to ambush army or police coming down this road. The SAS, through intelligence, found out where we were and the weapons we had. So they sent in a unit. Five SAS soldiers hit the front door and three hit the back door. It was a shootout. We're shooting at each other. It was then that we noticed that one of the soldiers had dropped and he actually fell at this five spot. And that was Captain Herbert Westmacott. He was the leader of the active service unit that was killed. After about an hour, the army came on the scene, the regular army. There was tanks, armored cars here, about 100-odd soldiers. Loud haters telling us to come out with our hands up. We refused to come out until the priest came, so the local parish priest, because we thought, well, maybe we're coming down the stairs or with our hands up, we're going to be shot dead. So the priest came down, we put the weapons out the window for people to see, and when I was coming out of here, they told me to put my hands up in the air. I refused to do that. There was a crowd of young people from my community over there. So I basically did the Republican thing and shouted up the Republic, things like that there. I was getting in the back of the armored car. I noticed the body, and there was a blanket over him, and there was somebody saying a prayer. I think it was a local solicitor come over, and he was saying a prayer in his ear, but Cap Westmacott was dead on the spot.
So what's it like returning here, Joe?
Well, as I said, the odd time I would take a walk up here, if I'm going up shopping or something, I always pause at this spot and say a prayer. I mean, I was a soldier in the Irish Republican Army, and I'm proud that I fought for that, but at the other end of that, there's also the human side of that, that this man was a father. He had a couple of kids, mother and father, siblings. He was retiring from the Army, I think moving into Australia or something, or New Zealand, to farm. So you have an understanding of that his family lost a life. He was a victim of an age-old historical conflict between England and Ireland, and Ireland's quest to be free.
There's a way to make an entrance.
This is my destiny.
It was now a conspiracy of witches.
Download Vili today.
The British government did not recognise the IRA, and so its volunteers were treated as common criminals rather than soldiers. Joe therefore faced a murder charge for killing the SAS captain. He was remanded in custody to Crumlin Road Prison, where his personal quest for freedom began.
Went straight to the Crumlin Road Prison. 13 months later, we smuggled guns in June of 1981. During the hunger strikes, myself and another seven volunteers, we tied up guards. I put on a uniform and we basically shot our way out of the prison. So I was sent to New York. I arrived in New York in 1982. You know, young lad, was 24 years of age, got a job in construction sites and things like that there. Had an Italian girlfriend, had an apartment, paying taxes, no lip my name. And then in June of 1983, I was arrested by the FBI. And under an extradition warrant. And that was to get me back for the shootout and for the escape. The American courts a year later refused to extradite me back.
Joe's case received huge support in the United States. He was held in custody without charge for 9 years, the longest in American history. When Margaret Thatcher tried to intervene, she unwittingly turned Joe into an American hero. The city of New York acknowledged the support its citizens gave Joe by naming an intersection Joseph Doherty Corner.
Margaret Thatcher, president or prime minister at the time, went into a bit of a rage with Ronald Reagan to why the American courts don't recognise me as a criminal, as a terrorist, and why am I protected. But at the end of the day, what we were saying to the American courts was it was a conflict, it's a historical conflict, come back on to this a few years, in a sense that there was a justification to why I joined the IRA, and the American courts, they supported that. So what happened over the next 9 years was the Americans kept appealing. They kept losing, they kept appealing, they kept losing, until finally it went to the US Supreme Court. So in 1992, I was deported, I was sent back. I come back into the city in February of 1992. I was in the Crumlin Road prison. Then 3 weeks later, I was moved down to his blocks, and I stayed there for the next 6.5 years until finally the conflict had ended, the Good Friday Agreement came in, and I was finally released.
Loyalists like Johnny Adair and Sam McCrory had been taught from a very early age that all Catholics were their enemy, but nobody ever explained to them why.
I was about 8 or 9 when the Troubles just broke out for real in 1969. And from there on, right through my teenage and adult whole life, we were just brought up hating everything Catholic and Republican. We felt threatened, and it was drummed into us that these people hated us and they wanted to kill us because they didn't like everything British. People were burned out of their homes, Protestants in one area and Catholics in the other, and mixed areas. And then it went on that both communities just lived in separate areas, like, for example, the Falls and the Shankill. Shankill was Protestants and Catholics. Falls was Catholics. We went on to join the Loyalist Paramilitary Group, namely the Ulster Defence Association, which was illegal in them times. And this is just throughout the years, as the Troubles progressed and got worse, and we were just born into them.
Just as you grow up and you're in your area and you see the attacks you were coming under by the Republican movement and the nationalist community, you just decided enough was enough, because the government weren't giving you any hand and the soldiers and the police weren't giving you any hand. So you decided to take matters in your own hand, join a paramilitary and fight back.
These paramilitary groups were based in our areas, in our communities, and we felt that these were the protectors. And we felt that by joining these paramilitary organisations, we would be defending and protecting our people. We felt, as Sammy outlined, that the police and the soldiers weren't going far enough to stop the IRA threat. I mean, it was a constant threat of bombs and shootings on a daily basis.
The UDA wasn't really militant in the early 80s and the 70s and all. That was just sort of sectarian. But when Johnny took over, it was sort of picking your Republican targets. It wasn't just any person done. They were picking Sinn Féin, IRA members, INLA, IPLO, IRSP. They were targeting the proper people. They were targeting the fundraising machine that was getting the Republican movement, and that was all through him.
Myself became a hate figure to the Republican Catholic community.
Adair has survived 13 assassination attempts on his life, most of which were carried out by the IRA or the INLA. In October 1993, his office was blown up. 9 innocent civilians died, as did the IRA volunteer who was planting the device.
They walked into the face shop, which was below the UDA offices up the stairs, dressed as face, masquerading as face delivery man, with a tray with a bomb on it and a few second fuse, and then detonated the fuse, and the bomb went off premature. And their intention was to kill myself and anybody else that was up the stairs and the UDA offices at the time. The organisation that we belonged to was involved in shootings and bombings. This was an organisation that myself, I was sent to prison for being a member of that organisation, and indeed a leader of it. I'd been to prison on a number of occasions for attempted murders of Sinn Féin members, possession of weapons, membership, and the most serious charge would have been directing terrorism, where I received 16 years in prison for that.
What about you, Skill? What were you in prison for?
Conspiracy to murder. 5 of us, 1 the leading car, 4 in a hijacked car, were caught with an AK-47 machine gun, the handgun, going up into West Belfast to kill the leader of Belfast IRA. So we were caught en route So, but before they'd been done 2 1-year remands for attempted murders, kidnapping, hijacking, and lifted numerous times along with Johnny for numerous murders, numerous attempted murders, numerous bombings and shootings. But it was all par for course. I mean, it's just part and parcel of the game.
So how long did you serve in the maze, and what was that like, the maze prison?
I'd done 6 years, 10 months.
I received 6 years. The authorities run the prison, right? They locked us up at night, but we run the places that we were in, namely the H blocks. We had total control of them. The only thing we couldn't do was go home at night. I mean, there was prison officers, but they stayed out in a circle. And we could get anything into that jail that we wanted, anything. And I'll give you an instance myself. I wanted a dog. So I had a visitor smuggle me in a dog. But what they'd done on the way through, they drugged the dog so it was sleeping. And he put it down his tracksuit bottoms. And when he went into the search area, the wee dog came round and started and the prison officer, what says the wee dog? But they just laughed him and sent him on out. And had he have got through the visit with the dog, like the screws, once I got it onto the wing, they weren't getting it out. That's the way we run the jail. But sadly, there was an incident where they killed the LVAF leader, Billy Wright. The NLA, some NLA prisoners who shared the same H block. When he was going to a visit one Saturday morning, he was shot dead by. So that's the extent of being able to smuggle stuff in. They were able to smuggle in two guns and shoot a man in the highest security prison in Europe.
In January 1998, Northern Ireland Secretary Mo Molum entered the Maze prison for a meeting with Johnny Mad Dog Adair and the head of the UDA prisoners, Sam Skelly McCrory. The two men listened intently as Mo spelled out her vision of peace in the province. Leaders of both loyalist and nationalist groups had realised some time ago that the war could not be won, and so whispers about a ceasefire began to emerge.
There was a lot of behind-the-scenes talks and negotiations going on before it became about. So it was a process that was ongoing for years. And I myself was involved in that process where we were meeting privately out of the spotlight, away from the public. And there was where most of the hard work was done till we got to the point that we were, when the Good Friday Agreement came about. When the peace process ended, well, there was no longer need for either the IRA or loyalist paramilitaries, but they still exist today, but they exist only for criminality, and criminality only.
We were there to defend our communities, see the people now, 20 years fast forward, are terrorising their own communities, they're flooding them with drugs, you know what I mean? They're shooting people dead on a monthly basis, or knee camp or punishment beatings, for no reason. So the very people that we fought to protect, they are now terrorising them. They're nothing but, honestly, they're using the name as loyalists, they're using it as a cover name as gangsterism. And that's all, they're just terrorising their own community, the very community that we protected.
Described by the media as the godfather of Ireland's drug-fueled crime wave, Christy Dunne is not a man who enjoys talking about his colourful past. His father was charged with murder, but convicted of manslaughter. After he was imprisoned, Christy became the head of the family. With 16 brothers and sisters and the legacy of his father's reputation in the underworld, his task was never going to be easy.
I never got a moment's peace from the police. And because I was the head of the family, you know what they say about cutting the head off? That's the way the police viewed me. The most indelible memory going back to my childhood would be when I made my confirmation. And I was confirmed by a Dublin bishop by the same name, Dunn. And I was confirmed in St. Kevin's Church in our area where I was living, and received this slap across the face, and had believed all this time to this present day, 77 years of age, that I was confirmed, only to discover that because of my father being in prison at the time, I was targeted and scapegoated as a future enemy of the state, if you like.
Why were all these people, the police and everyone else, trying to demonise the Dunns, you know, what?
They listen to what they're told and they act upon what they're told, And they don't care whether you're a good person or you're a bad person. And if you have the name Dunn, that's it, you're finished.
Surely the Dunns, not as a unit, but individuals, you know, got involved in, maybe inevitably got involved in crime.
Like, I'm Christy Dunn, right? Yeah. And I'm not my brother's keeper. They all have their own personality. But as far as I'm concerned, none of my brothers were bullies. They never took liberties with people. They never exploited people. What they were doing was their business.
It is, of course, unreasonable to claim that any villain's business is his own because crime affects victims. In December 1988, a four-man gang kidnapped the Dublin postmaster, his wife and two children. Dunn took no physical part in the crime, but had recorded a threatening message demanding the family cooperate. The following morning, candles were strapped to the postmaster's back and he was told that they were explosives. He then made his way to work, collected £80,000 in cash, which he then handed over in exchange for his family. Dunn was convicted and sentenced to 10 years imprisonment, although he maintains his innocence.
I was accused of tying a bomb onto the postmaster's back. And indeed, I remember when my trial was in court and they were given the evidence about the bomb on the postmaster's back. And it was so dramatic that when it got down to the bare essentials, that the bomb on his back was removed and it turned out to be candles, everybody in the court broke into fits of laughter. And I remember the trial judge at the time, a fellow called Lynch, Dominic Lynch, turning around sharply and looking at me to see my reaction. I didn't think it was funny. I thought it must have been very traumatic for the postmaster. But the point is, I didn't do what I was charged with. Every vestige of law was ignored in my case. I was just processed into prison. That conviction, I'd been denied an appeal. And until such time as I receive an appeal, I'm an innocent man.
Despite his reputation and convictions, Christy maintains that he is a victim of unwarranted prejudice. He does, however, concede that in keeping with his godfather moniker, his role in crime has been more managerial than that of a foot soldier.
I wasn't really involved in going out and committing serious crimes or anything like that. I'd say I would have relied on my intelligence and, like, I wasn't foolish or stupid, but I certainly know I never hurted anybody. And I'm very annoyed about the fact that I was convicted for the Finglas post office, because throughout that trial it was alleged that a young child had been threatened and all that kind of stuff. And look, they called me the godfather, the official godfather of Ireland. I just don't want to know about being a godfather. Like, I would have known about all these type crimes. I mean, I remember the first security van that was ever robbed in Dublin. And I remember the biggest crimes that happened in Dublin. But although I may have got blamed for them, the finger was pointing at me. I mean, it didn't necessarily mean that I did them. And whether I did them or not, I still got blamed for them. I didn't have to go out and rob banks or security vans or jewelers. I was capable of doing it, but I didn't have to. But I knew people around me were more capable than me.
So you was more of a managerial role?
An advisor, maybe.
The Dunn family is blamed for being the first people to import heroin into Ireland. Out of 17 children, at least 10 have convictions involving the drug. At least five of the brothers became addicts, and Larry Dunn's wife Anita died after contracting AIDS through sharing a needle. Despite the family's inescapable links to this foul drug, Christy claims that Larry, who was responsible for organising the importations, was framed.
My brother Larry, was like the Titanic to the Dunn family. He brought us all down. When the police came to my brother's home. They searched the home, they left the home, and said, right, that's okay. They found nothing. And then suddenly they came back about 20 minutes later, knocked on the door again, and one fella said, I forgot to search a room upstairs. And of course, Larry let him back into the house, and then they found some. So what does that imply? When the heroin hit the streets of Dublin, nobody realized the damage, nor the consequences of this devil's poison, as I call it. It wasn't long before it became obvious the effects of this drug. It was easy for the police, for the politicians, and for everybody else concerned, right, to blame the Dons. It was easy. That's the power these people have. And I wouldn't like to have that type of power. I'm a victim of that abusive power. I've suffered at the hands of policemen all my life. At least I have the chance to speak out. It's like Paddy Hill said, they did not care whether we were innocent or not, right? They don't understand justice. They wouldn't even know how to spell the word. I've been through all that. I've been through all that, not once, not once, many times, many times.
The Dunn's legacy of heroin is there for all to see on the streets of Dublin. In 1985, Larry Dunn was sentenced to 14 years imprisonment for possession of heroin with intent to supply. As he was being led to the cells, Larry made an infamous prophecy. If you think we're bad, wait until you see what's coming after us. One of the people Dunn had warned society about was Dubliner Wayne Hart. Through his Republican connections, Hart obtained firearms that were used to commit robberies. During one robbery, a loaded weapon went off accidentally and his accomplice was shot dead. Hart ended up in Mountjoy Prison, a place he described as a breeding ground for Ireland's criminal hierarchy.
We meant to pick the guns up and the gun was loaded. The gun went out in the van and he died. Kind of, he was torn this way and it went through his shoulder and out through his heart. He ended up in here, Mountjoy. But that was a breeding ground for me because I met a lot of people, you know what I mean? A lot of people that have since either been shot dead or have rose to the top and been shot dead or they're out of the country, you know? A lot of my friends have been whacked over the years. But I kind of got to a point then when I started smoking heroin myself.
In the prison?
Yeah, yeah. And it was just a kind of way of coping, a way of dealing. You know what I mean? Because especially, you know, back then, it's the same now, like, you know. You go in and you have a name going in and then you're in for a shooting. Regardless of whether it was an accident or not. The dogs on the street don't hear it was an accident. I want to know it's an accident, you know what I mean? Whatever crew is around you, you know what I mean? I'm putting you up on the pedestal and my name would have got used for so many different things and threatening people and this, that, and that. And then I had to live up to it inside.
Hart returned to the street where he used all that he had learned in Mountjoy to build a drug empire that transformed his life and destroyed hundreds of others.
Coolock, Kilbarrick, it's a big area. There was a lot of youth, so there was a lot of demand. So we got this bleeding brainwave, you know, you had to go into town to get a deal of hash, and a deal of hash was £10. So I says, well, right, well, I'm going to get hash and I'm going to sell it, but I'm going to make £5 deals. So it was easier for people to access and get, like, you know what I mean? And kind of done that and just kind of took off from that, you know, getting a few ounces, then a 9-bar, and then people would get windy, you know what I mean? And people would come to you and do you want this and do you want that, you know what I mean? By the time I was in my early 20s, so I was knocking out 50k a week. You know, I was at the boy my first house, I was about 21, and it was just around the corner from where I was. And at the time, I think it was 25,000 a punt. But back in 1990, 1991, that was a lot of money. You know what I mean? Ireland was in the thick, in the grips of a recession.
Unlike most dealers, Hart did not cut heroin with additive agents. Instead, he sold high-quality heroin in bags half the normal size for half the normal price. It was a wise business move, but the purity of the drug resulted in the deaths of many users.
I had people selling heroin for me, you know what I mean, the late 80s, early 90s, and there was serious profit to be made off over here. I don't know, you probably heard of King Scum. Heroin used to be sold in 10-pound packs. He was the only one that had heroin bringing it in with the Duns, with Christy Dunn and all them. And they all got locked up, and he poured up the 40 pound, 40 punt, like, at the time. A 10-pound bag up to 40, the 40 quid. So hence he got the name. So what I done was, again, I seen a market, and I put them from 40 pound down to 10 pound. Smaller bags, you know what I mean? The quantity was better. So the batches were flying out quicker. They were smaller, but the stuff was stronger. You know what I mean? But people were, if I had been giving out normal size bags, there'd have been a lot more debts. You know, I got away with a lot over the years.
How pure was the heroin you were bringing
in? One was 52%, the second one was 57%, which is massive, because even now today, you know what I mean, people are probably getting 20-25%. Yeah, I remember a guard stopped me one day and he was saying, "Hey, do you want to bleed and cut your heroin? It's killing people. There's people fucking dropping left, right and centre." And I was like, "Fuck off, I don't sell drugs."
When peace was declared in Northern Ireland, the only route to securing power left open was via the ballot box. In the hope of securing votes, the IRA dispatched their redundant terrorists to deprived housing estates, where they were under orders to rid decent people's lives of drug dealers. Soon villains were masquerading as vote-seeking vigilantes in order to rob their rivals. One evening, men posing as IRA volunteers raided Hart's home.
They kicked the door in, yeah, you know what I mean, and they were looking for me and put the lads in the ground with guns, and the lads were saying, "No, he's not here," you know what I mean? And then I asked the lads, "Have they got gloves in them?" I said, "No." I said, "They locked whore in the bathroom and they brought Jews into the separate room," so they were at the handling doors all over the fucking place. So they were either very fucking stupid or they weren't well trained, you know. So as I said, I had connections. Within 2 hours, so we found out who they were. Do you know what I mean? They were more like activists. People like to say they're part of something. A lot of them aren't. Sometimes they're just fucking paper sellers, half of them. Armchair IRA men.
Armchair IRA men or not, Wayne knew that gunmen or the police could return to his home at any time. Quite simply, he had had enough.
I just got to a point in my life now where I had a fuck enough. I was never bleeding happy. I was always driven. I got something. I wanted more. You know what I mean? I had the best looking board. I wanted your board. You know? I had a good car. I wanted your car. I had a good house. I wanted your house. I was never happy. I was never content. I always wanted. I was always driven. You know? And I didn't care what I'd done, who I'd done, who I stepped over. That includes family, friends, my kids. You know, stuff that I kind of, I came to regret. And then the heroin kind of took all that away. You know what I mean? I was kind of like, I was in a different world, different fucking zone, you know? And I just got to a point in my life now where I had a fuck enough. You know what I mean? I had enough. I knew I was either going to kill someone, I was going to end up getting a life sentence, or I was going to be killed. You know, a lot of my friends, even my best man at my wedding and all, they're all dead, they're all whacked.
Not every paramilitary involved in targeting drug dealers did so in the hope of attracting votes. The majority did so because they were dealing drugs themselves and wanted to protect their patch. Buffalo Billy Clare shoots and bombs drug dealers simply because he loathes them and the damage their vile trade does to society. Described by the Irish media as a psychotic thug who terrorises communities, Clare prefers to see himself as a man on a mission for the good of all.
At an early age, I became involved in the Wolfton Society in London, and that was a kind of a springboard to the extreme republicanism then, when the Provisional IRA.
What sort of operations were you sent on when you were in the IRA in Dublin?
The ones that I can discuss about mostly were actually directed towards drug dealers and that kind of activity.
But when you say they targeted drug dealers, what did they do? Name them and shame them, or?
Well, execute them.
Execute them?
Yeah.
And can you give any examples of incidents?
You know, as I said, you don't come to fight big drug gangs who have assets behind them using Salvation Army tactics. You got to hit them with full strength and everything you got, you know, and look for their weakness and
when you find a weakness, you know, that's you know, whether it's kidnapping, shootings, petrol bombings, grenades, whatever, you know, is being used on them. You know, people would support that, I suppose, because these people are devastating communities. And, you know, they don't care about what they sell or who they sell it to. So you must meet them with the same train of thought, that you don't care about them or their families.
Before any direct action is taken, it has to be established that the intended target is guilty of the alleged offence.
There obviously would be an intense investigation into that person and his activities, and before any decisive action was taken.
Are they warned? Are they, you know?
Well, it would be highly unlikely that they would be warned. It would be a highly unlikely situation if a drug dealer was warned, or that he was going to be kidnapped, if he was going to be abducted or punishment, shooting or executed.
Billy's hatred for drug dealers resulted in his expulsion from the IRA. However, the more extreme Republican group, the INLA, saw his passion to beat, shoot and bomb those that peddle misery as an asset rather than a hindrance.
I was expelled for my war against the drug dealers in Dublin. The INLA were much more smaller, you know, but if not ruthless organisation, but certainly my time within the INLA, we had the same, most of its members in Dublin had the same train of thought, and it was extreme, extreme violence.
Did they execute any notorious drug dealers?
Well, again, there was people executed on the INLA's watch.
And where did your time at the INLA come to an end?
You know, the late 90s, running into 2000, mid-2000s, where you had the likes of Declan Duffy, who was leader of the INLA in Dublin, who was you know, was a character, you know, was involved in backing up drug dealers. And supporting drug dealers while pretending to be some kind of crusader against drug dealers. But, you know, he's unscruepulous people. And
So what happened to Duffy then? He was expelled from Dublin?
He was expelled and he was sent packing from the capital.
But he's not dead now?
He's not dead.
All right.
Yet.
Declan Duffy was wanted for the murder of a British soldier at the time he was associating with Clare. Duffy and others shot Sergeant Michael Newman in the head outside a recruiting office in Derby. Previous targets of Clare's include drug dealers Jimmy the Whale Gantley and Bernie Sugg, a key member of the Westies gang. They controlled the sale of drugs in West Dublin, and those that owed them money or otherwise displeased suffered horrific torture.
These Westies, these characters who were, you know, where we had one incident where they were causing chaos and havoc in Blanchestown. Bernard Suggs, or Verb as they call him, he was asked to come to a meeting, and when he came to the meeting, he was asked to desist from his activities and leave the area. He refused to do so, and as a result of that meeting, he was blasted twice in the stomach and left squealing on the ground like a pig and the rat he was. You have to show these people more violence than they have imagined, because these people live on a pedestal that because you're a drug dealer, they must be violent and they must be feared.
In 2010, Billy was left clinically dead following his arrest for the murder of 26-year-old Stephen Amira. Father of three, Amira was shot but still alive when his killer took him into the woods to a pre-dug grave, threw him into the hole and buried him alive.
I was surrounded by police in balaclavas with Heckler & Koch machine guns and Glock pistols, all automatic weapons, having no regard for the public safety, surrounded me in a circle formation with automatic weapons, and I was rendered unconscious. And I think it was later on that day where I was rushed into hospital in Dublin. And I was pronounced clinically dead for a short while. Later it transpired that they had forced me to drink poison, and there was absolutely no investigation into my attempted murder in by the Irish police.
When you woke up in the hospital, were you just in a normal ward, or were you free to move about?
No, I wasn't free. I was chained to the bed, hands and feet.
In the hospital bed?
In the hospital bed, under armed guard. No one allowed in, no one allowed out. No solicitors, no family members, no nothing.
And what about the interrogation and where they held you? What was that like?
Well, I was arrested for murder and taken to a police station, Irish Force Police station, and interrogated for 7 days.
What about today? Are you a member of any group now? Or
No. I distance myself now from republicanism completely. And as we speak today, I see them now. I see republicans in Dublin, the likes of the real IRA. I class them now as a legitimate target. They're as far as I was concerned, that they work hand in hand with senior drug dealers both here and in Spain. The leader of the real IRA in Dublin, his name was Alan Ryan. He was an unscrupulous character and not very likable fella. You know, a womanizer and basically a coward. And, you know, every dog has his day. And I suppose drug dealers, you know, had enough of him because, you know, they were taken. They were taken, and, you know, using the money for themselves and on holidays, cars, putting cameras outside their houses and, you know, lining their own pockets, you know, showing signs of wealth. And, you know, so I mean, he met his demise, and you know, I'd have as much sympathy for him going as I would for any other drug dealer.
One suspects that Billy's life insurance premiums are higher than the average mortgage, and he must have as many fans as enemies. Sinner or saint, it's hard to decide, but it's pretty much odds on that he will never reach an old age.
I think the only time I'll stop is when I take my last breath.
Which may come about because of somebody else wanting to take you out.
Well, I'm the same as any other person, but you know, I don't take it as a, you know, we just do what we do, and you know, we don't gloat, and you know, if somebody
doesn't
wants
that to, bother you though?
Not in the slightest.
And do you think you are a target for some people?
It's quite possible. Some of these drug dealers and gangsters blow some of that stuff up their nose and might dream and talk about it, but you know, we're here. I'm here. I'm here. I'm not hiding. I'm here, so I'm up front and centre.
In 1981, I served on the streets of Northern Ireland with the British Army. Aged just 21, I hadn't enlisted through choice. A magistrate had warned me that if I didn't honour my claim that I was going to join the army within 6 months, I would be going to jail. After serving 3 years, I left and ended up in prison twice for wounding before fleeing to South Africa to avoid a looming third jail sentence. I found work as a bouncer on Johannesburg's Murder Mile, and inevitably I ended up back in a prison cell. I escaped from Africa and in the summer of 1986 arrived in Basildon, Essex. I had witnessed horror and human suffering on the streets of Ulster and Johannesburg, but nothing could have prepared me for the psychotic violence I was to experience in the Essex Badlands.
All you gangsters and clowns who are shooting up the town.